as currently configured. No one could say for sure what caused the flash crash. For the same reason, no one could prove that high-frequency traders were front-running the orders of ordinary investors. The data didn't exist. But Brad sensed that the investment community was not persuaded by the SEC's explanation and by the assurances of the stock exchanges that all was well inside them. A lot of them asked the same question he was asking himself. Isn't there a much deeper question of how this one snowball caused a deadly avalanche? He watched the most sophisticated investors respond after Duncan Niederauer, the CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, embarked on a goodwill tour, the purpose of which seemed to be to explain why the New York Stock Exchange had nothing to do with the flash crash. "That's when a light went off," said Danny Moses of Seawolf Capital, a hedge fund that specialized in stock market investments. He had heard Brad and Ronan's pitch. Niederauer was saying, "Hey, have confidence in us. It wasn't us." "Wait a minute. I never thought it was you. Why should I be concerned that it was you?" "It was like your kid walks into your house and says to you, 'Dad, I didn't dent your car.'" "Wait, there's a dent in my car?" After the flash crash, Brad no longer bothered to call investors to set up meetings. His phone rang off the hook. "What the flash crash did," said Brad, "was it opened the buy side's willingness to understand what was going on, because their bosses started asking questions, which meant that our telling the truth and explaining it to them fit perfectly." A few months later, in September 2010, another strange, albeit more obscure, market event occurred, this time in the Chicago suburbs. A sleepy stock exchange called the CBSX, which traded just a tiny fraction of total stock market volume, announced that it was going to invert the usual system of fees and kickbacks. It was now going to pay people to take liquidity and charge people to make it. Once again, this struck Brad as bizarre. Who would make markets on exchanges if they had to pay to do it? But then the CBSX exploded with activity. Over the next several weeks, for example, it handled a third of the total volume of the shares traded in Sirius, the satellite radio company. Brad knew that Sirius was a favorite stock of HFT firms, but he couldn't understand why it was suddenly trading in huge volume in Chicago. Obviously, when they saw they could be paid to take on the CBSX, the big Wall Street brokers all responded by reprogramming their routers so that their customers' orders were sent to the CBSX. But who was on the other side of their trades, paying more than ever had been paid for the privilege? That's when Ronan told Brad about a new company called Spread Networks. Spread Networks, as it turned out, had tried to hire Ronan to sell its precious line to high-frequency traders. They had walked Ronan through their astonishing tunneling project and their business plans. "I told them they were fucking bananas," said Ronan. "They said they were going to sell 200 of these things. I came up with a list of 28 firms who would potentially buy the line. Plus, they were charging $10.6 million up front for 5 years' worth of service, and they wanted to pay me $12,000 for each one I sold, which is just an insult. You might as well ask me to blow you while I'm doing it." Ronan mentioned this unpleasant experience to Brad, who naturally said, "You're telling me this now?" Ronan explained that he hadn't been able to mention Spread before, because he had signed a non-disclosure agreement with the company. The agreement had expired that day, and so now he was free to disclose not only what Spread had done, but for whom they had done it. Not just HFT firms like Knight and Citadel, but also the big Wall Street banks, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and others. You couldn't prove what these guys were doing was a big deal, because they were so guarded about how much money they were making, said Brad. But you could see how big a deal it was by how much they spent. And now the banks were involved. I thought, oh shit, this isn't just HFT shops. This is industry-wide. It's systemic. Ronan offered an explanation for what had just happened on the CBSX. Spread Networks had flipped its switch and turned itself on just 2 weeks earlier. CBSX then inverted its pricing. By inverting its pricing, by paying brokers to execute customers' trades for which they would normally be charged a fee, the exchange enticed the brokers to send their customers' orders to the CBSX so that they might be front-run back to New Jersey by high-frequency traders using spread networks. The information that high-frequency traders glean from trading with investors in Chicago, they could use back in the markets in New Jersey. It was now very much worth it to them to pay the CBSX to make liquidity. It was exactly the game they had played on BATS, of enticing brokers to reveal their customers' intentions so that they might exploit them elsewhere. But racing a customer order from Weehawken to other points in New Jersey was hard compared to racing it from Chicago on Spread's new line. Spread was another piece of what was becoming a fantastically elaborate puzzle. The team Brad was assembling at RBC didn't have all the pieces to the puzzle, not yet, but they had more of them than anyone else willing to talk openly on the subject. The reactions of investors to what they already knew, they considered as simply more pieces of the puzzle. Every now and then, perhaps 5% of the time, Brad or Ronan met some investor who didn't care to know about the puzzle, someone who didn't want to hear their story. Whenever Brad returned from one of these meetings, he'd discover that the person to whom he had just spoken depended, one way or another, on the revenues flowing to high-frequency traders. Every now and then, maybe another 5% of the time, they met with an investor who was completely terrified. They knew so little, and they'd be so scared inside their own firms that they'd rather the meeting never happen, said Brad. But most of the hundreds of big-time investors with whom Brad and Ronan spoke had the same reaction as T. Rowe Price's Mike Gitlin. They knew something was very wrong, but they didn't know what. And now that they knew, they were outraged. Brad was the honest broker, said Gitlin. I don't know how many knew it, but he was the only guy who would say it. He was saying, I'm here. And I'm watching it, and we're a party to it, and the whole thing is rigged. He exposed people who were bad actors, and a lot of people in this industry are afraid to do that. He was saying, this is just offensive. Vincent Daniel, the head strategist at Seawolf, put it another way. He took a long look at this unlikely pair, a Canadian-Asian guy from this bank no one cared about, and this Irish guy who was doing a fair impression of a Dublin handyman, who had just told him the most incredible, true story he had ever heard, and said, "Your biggest competitive advantage is that you don't want to fuck me." Trust on Wall Street was still just possible. The big investors who trusted Brad began to share whatever information they could get their hands on from their other brokers, information Brad was never meant to see. For instance, several demanded to know from their other Wall Street brokers what percentage of the trades executed on their behalf were executed inside the broker's dark pools. These dark pools contain the murkiest financial incentives in the new stock market. Goldman Sachs and Credit Suisse ran the most prominent dark pools, but every brokerage firm strongly encouraged investors who wanted to buy or sell big chunks of stock to do so in that firm's dark pool. In theory, the brokers were meant to find the best price for their customers, If the customer wanted to buy shares in Chevron, and the best price happened to be on the New York Stock Exchange, the broker was not supposed to stick the customer with a worse price inside their dark pool. But the dark pools were opaque. Their rules were not published. No outsider could see what went on inside them. It was entirely possible that a broker's own traders were trading against the customers in the dark pool. There were no rules against it. And while the brokers often protested that there were no conflicts of interest inside their dark pools, all the dark pools exhibited the same strange property. A huge percentage of the customer orders sent into a dark pool were executed inside the pool. Brad knew this because a handful of the world's biggest stock market investors had shared their information with him, so that he might help them figure out what was going on. It was hard to explain. A broker was expected to find the best possible price in the market for his customer. The Goldman Sachs dark pool, to take one example, was less than 2% of the entire stock market. So why did nearly 50% of the customer orders routed into Goldman's dark pool end up being executed inside that pool rather than out in the wider market? Most of the broker's dark pools constituted less than 1% of the entire market, and yet somehow those brokers found the best price for their customers between 15 and 60% of the time. So-called rates of internalization varied from broker to broker. And because the dark pool was not required to say exactly when it had executed a trade, and the broker did not typically tell his investors where it had executed a trade, much less the market conditions at the moment of execution, the customer lived in darkness. Even a giant investor like T. Rowe Price simply had to take it on faith that Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch had acted in its interest, despite the obvious financial incentives not to do so. As Mike Gitlin said, "It's just very hard to prove that any broker-dealer is routing the trades to some place other than the place that is best for you. You couldn't see what any given broker was doing. If an investor as large as T. Rowe Price, which acted on behalf of millions of small investors, was unable to obtain from its stockbrokers the information it needed to determine if the brokers had acted in their interest, what chance did the little guy have?" In this environment, the effect of trying to help investors see what was happening to their money was revolutionary. The Royal Bank of Canada had never been anything more than the most trivial player in the U.S. stock market. At the end of 2010, Brad saw a report from Greenwich Associates, the firm used by Wall Street banks to evaluate their standing in relation to their peers. Greenwich Associates interviews the investors who use Wall Street's services and privately reports their findings to the Wall Street firms. In 2009, RBC had, at number 19, been far down Greenwich Associates' stock market rankings. At the end of 2010, after only 6 months of Thor, RBC was ranked number one. Greenwich Associates called RBC to ask what on earth was going on within the bank. In the history of their rankings, they said, they had never seen a firm jump more than three spots. At the same time, this movement spawned by Brad Katsuyama's unhappiness with Wall Street was starting to feel less like a business than a cause. Brad was no radical. As he put it, "There's a difference between choosing a crusade and having it thrust on you." He'd never really thought all that much about how he fit into the bigger picture, and certainly never considered himself a character upon a stage. He'd never run for student council. He'd never had anything to do with politics. It's always seemed to me that the things you need to do to influence change had to do with glad-handing, he said. It just felt so phony. This didn't feel phony. This felt like a situation in which a person, through his immediate actions, might change the world. After all, he was now educating the world's biggest money managers about the inner workings of the stock market, which strongly suggested to him that no one else on Wall Street was willing to teach them how their investment dollars were being abused. The more he understood the inner workings of the financial system, the better he might inform the investors, big and small, who were being abused by that system, and the more pressure they might bring to bear on the system to change. The deep problem with the system was a kind of moral inertia. So long as it served the narrow self-interests of everyone inside it, no one on the inside would ever seek to change it, no matter how corrupt or sinister it became. Though even to use words like corrupt and sinister made serious people uncomfortable, and so Brad avoided them. Maybe his biggest concern when he spoke to investors was that he'd be seen as just another nut with a conspiracy theory. One of the compliments that made him happiest was when a big investor said, "Thank God, finally there's someone who knows something about high-frequency trading who isn't an Area 51 guy." Because he wasn't a radical, it took him a while to figure out that fate and circumstance had created for him a dramatic role, which he was obliged to play. One night he actually turned to Ashley, now his wife, and said, "It feels like I'm an expert in something that badly needs to be changed. I think there's only a few people in the world who can do anything about this. If I don't do something right now, me, Brad Katsuyama, there's no one to call." Chapter 4. Tracking the Predator. By the end of 2010, they'd built a marketable weapon. The weapon promised to defend investors in the U.S. stock market from what appeared to be a new kind of market predator. About that predator, they knew surprisingly little. Apart from Ronan, Brad knew no one from inside the world of high-frequency trading. He had only a vague idea of that world's reach or its political influence. From Ronan, he knew that the HFT firms enjoyed special relationships with the public stock exchanges, but he knew nothing about their dealings with the big Wall Street banks tasked with guarding the interests of investors. Then again, many of the people who worked inside the Wall Street banks seemed to have only the faintest idea of what those banks were up to. If you worked for a big Wall Street bank, the easiest way to find out what other banks were up to was to seek out their employees who were looking for new jobs and interview them. In the wake of the financial crisis, the too-big-to-fail end of Wall Street was in turmoil, and Brad was able to talk to people who, just a few years before, would never have considered working for the Royal Bank of Canada. By the time he was finished picking their collective brains, he had spoken to more than 100 employees at too-big-to-fail banks, but hired only about 35 of them. "They all wanted jobs," he said. "It's not that they wouldn't tell me, it's that they didn't know how their own electronic systems worked." The thread running through all these people, even the ones he didn't hire, was their fear and distrust of the system. John Schwall was a curious case in point. Schwall's father had been a firefighter on Staten Island, like his father before him. "Every male on my father's side is a fireman," Schwall said. "I wanted to do something more." More meant getting a master's in engineering from the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. In the late 1990s, he took a job at Bank of America Securities, where he rose to a position with an important-sounding title, Head of New Products. It is irritating to read about an American bank that insists on calling itself a bank. The bank, in this case, was pushed to do so, as the securities divisions within American banks, here Bank of America, are prohibited by regulators from referring to themselves as banks. His job description was more glamorous than his job. John Schwall was the guy behind the scenes who handled the boring details, like managing relations between the traders on the floor and the tech geeks who built stuff for them, or ensuring that the bank complied with new stock market regulations. He routinely ranked in the top 1% of all employees in Bank of America's reviews of its personnel, but his status in a Wall Street bank was akin to head butler to a British upper-class family. To the grunts in the back office, he might have seemed like a big shot, but to the traders who made the money, he did not. Whatever frustration this caused him, he buried. Given an excuse to feel loyalty for his company, he seized it. September 11, 2001, for instance. Schwall's desk was in the North Tower of the World Trade Center on the 81st floor. By sheer fluke, he had been late to work that morning, the only day in 2001 he would report late to work, and he'd watched the first plane hit, 13 floors above his desk, from the window of a distant bus. Several of his colleagues died that day, and so had some Staten Island firemen he had known. Schwall seldom spoke of the event, but privately he believed that, had he been at his desk when the plane hit, his instinct would have been to go up the stairs rather than down them. The guilt he felt for not having been on hand to help somehow became in his mind a debt he owed to his colleagues and to his employer, which is to say that Schwall wanted to feel toward a Wall Street bank what a fireman is meant to feel toward his company. "I thought I'd be at Bank of America forever," he said. Then came the financial crisis, and in 2008, the acquisition by Bank of America of a collapsing Merrill Lynch. What happened next upended Schwall's worldview. Merrill Lynch had been among the most prolific creators of the very worst subprime mortgage bonds. Had they been left to the mercy of the market, had Bank of America not saved them, the Merrill Lynch people would have been tossed out on the street. Instead, right before their acquisition, they awarded themselves massive bonuses that Bank of America wound up having to pay. "It was incredibly unfair," said Schwall. "It was incredibly unjust. My stock in this company I helped to build for 9 years goes into the shitter, and these assholes pay themselves record bonuses. It was a fucking crime." Even more incredibly, the Merrill Lynch people ended up in charge of Bank of America's equity division and set about firing most of the people in it. A lot of those people had been good, loyal employees of the bank. "Wall Street is corrupt, I decided," said Schwall afterwards. "There is no corporate loyalty to employees." Schwall was one of the few Bank of America people who kept his job. Merrill Lynch had no one to replace him. He hid his true feelings, but he no longer trusted his employer. And he sensed for the first time in his career that his employer did not trust him. One day he sent himself an email from his personal account to his work account. He was helping out some friends who had been fired by the bank and who wanted to start a small brokerage firm. His boss called him to ask him about it. "What the hell are they doing monitoring my incoming emails?" Schwall wondered. His ability to monitor his superiors exceeded their ability to monitor him, and he began to do it. "There was a lot of unspoken animosity," he said. He noticed the explosion of trading activity inside of Merrill Lynch's dark pool, fueled by high-frequency traders. He saw that Merrill Lynch created a new revenue line to account for the money paid to them by high-frequency trading firms for access to the Merrill Lynch dark pool. He noticed that the guy who had built the Merrill Lynch electronic trading platform was one of the highest-paid people in all of Merrill Lynch, and he had nevertheless quit to create a company that would cater to HFT firms. He noticed letters sent on bank letterhead to the Securities and Exchange Commission arguing against further stock market regulation. He saved one in which the bank's lawyers wrote that, despite numerous changes in recent years in both market structure and participant behavior, the equity market is functioning well today. One day he heard a rumor that the Merrill people had assigned an analyst to produce a report to prove that Merrill's stock market customers were better off because of whatever happened inside Merrill's dark pool. There was apparently some controversy around this report. Schwal filed that rumor away for later use. Schwal wanted to think of himself as a guy who lived by a few simple principles, a good soldier. After the financial crisis, he was more like the resentful butler. He had a taste for asking complicated questions and for tracking the answers into whatever rabbit hole they might lead him. He had, in short, an obsessive streak. It wasn't until after he'd hired Schwal away from Bank of America to work for RBC that Brad noticed this side of Schwal. He should have seen it before, simply from Schwal's chosen role on Wall Street, product manager. A product manager, to be any good, had to be obsessive. The role had been spawned by the widespread belief that traders didn't know how to talk to computer geeks, and that computer geeks did not respond rationally to big, hairy traders hollering at them. A product manager stood between the two groups to sort out which of the things the traders wanted that were the most important and how best to build them. For instance, an RBC stock market trader might demand a button on his screen that said Thor, which he could hit when he wanted Thor to execute his order to buy stock. To design that button might require 20 pages of mind-numbingly detailed specifications. That's where Schwal came in. He goes into details that no one else will go into, because for some reason, that's what he likes to do, said Brad. The first hint that Schwal's obsession with detail might take a sharp turn into some private cul-de-sac came in company meetings. He'd go off on complete tangents, said Brad. Semi-related, but outer space-type stuff. Another way Brad saw how Schwal's mind worked was in a fight that Schwal picked not long after he started working at RBC. The bank had declined an offer to serve as a lead sponsor for a charity called Wings Over Wall Street. Wings Over Wall Street raised money to combat amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. In response, and without explaining why, Schwal blasted a system-wide email explaining the importance of ALS research and encouraging all RBC employees to get behind Wings Over Wall Street. The RBC executives who had made the original decision understandably saw this rogue email as a political act intended to undermine their authority. For no apparent reason, Schwal had alienated a bunch of important people who had the power to fire him. Brad now found himself between his new, extremely valuable employee and a top RBC executive who wanted his scalp. When pressed, Schwal finally explained to Brad that his mother had just died of ALS. And he hadn't thought to mention it, said Brad. He'd spent years trying to figure out how to help his mother. The fact his mother died of the disease would have won the argument, and he never mentions it. He said it would have been underhanded and unprincipled. Schwal's problem wasn't an uncharming taste for corporate politics, but a charming ineptitude at playing them, Brad decided. Anyone who was politically astute never would have done this. He nevertheless stumbled into politics often enough and played them badly enough that Brad finally came up with a name for the resulting mess, a schwalling. A schwalling is when he does something unintentionally idiotic that makes him look stupid, said Brad. All Schwal would say is, I just sort of get crazy from time to time, He'd become obsessed with something, and his obsession sent him on a trip to a place from which the journey's origin could no longer be glimpsed. The result was a lot of activity without an obvious motive. Thor had triggered Schwal's private process. Thor, and what it implied about the U.S. financial system, became Schwal's greatest obsession. Before Brad explained to him how Thor worked and why, Schwal hadn't thought twice about the U.S. stock markets. After he met Brad, he was certain that the market at the heart of capitalism was rigged. "As soon as you realize this," he said, "as soon as you realize that you are not able to execute your orders because someone else is able to identify what you are trying to do and race ahead of you to the other exchanges, it's over," he said. "It changes your mind." He stewed on the situation. The longer he stewed, the angrier he became. "It really just pissed me off," he said, "that people set out this way to make money from everyone else's retirement account. I knew who was being screwed, people like my mom and pop, and I became hell-bent on figuring out who was doing the screwing." He reconsidered what he'd seen at Merrill Lynch after they had taken over Bank of America's stock trading department. He hunted down the analyst who had done the controversial analysis of Merrill's dark pool, for instance. The analyst told him that he had found that the dark pool was actually costing the customers while profiting Merrill Lynch, but that management did not want to hear it. "They kept on telling him to change his report," said Schwal. He was basically told that he had to find a different way to do it to get the answer they needed. Early one Monday morning, in the summer of 2011, Brad had a call from Schwal. He said, "Hey, I'm not coming in today," recalls Brad. And I said, "What's going on?" He just said, "Trust me." Then he disappeared. The previous night, Schwal had gone out into his backyard with nothing but a cigar, a chair, and his iPad. "I had the belief that some people were perpetuating a fraud. When you think HFT, what do you think? You think nothing. You don't have a person. You don't have a face. You think a computer. But there are specific people behind this." He started by Googling front running and Wall Street and scandal. What he was looking for at first was the cause of the problem Thor had solved. How was it legal for a handful of insiders to operate at faster speeds than the rest of the market, and in effect, steal from investors? He soon had his answer. Regulation, national market system. Passed by the SEC in 2005, but not implemented until 2007, Reg NMS, as it became known, required brokers to find the best market prices for the investors they represented. The regulation had been inspired by charges of front-running made in 2004 against two dozen specialists on the floor of the old New York Stock Exchange, a charge the specialists settled by paying a $241 million fine. Up till then, the various brokers who handled investors' stock market orders had been held to the loose standard of best execution. What that meant in practice was subject to interpretation. If you wanted to buy 10,000 shares of Microsoft at $30 a share, and the broker went into the market and saw that there were only 100 shares offered at $30, he might choose not to buy those 100 shares and wait until more sellers turned up. He had the discretion not to spook the market and to play your hand on your behalf as smartly as he could. After the brokers abused the trust implicit in that discretion once too often, the government took the discretion away. Reg NMS replaced the loose notion of best execution with the tight legal one of best price. To define best price, Reg NMS relied on the concept of the National Best Bid and Offer, known as the NBBO. If an investor wished to buy 10,000 shares of Microsoft and 100 shares were offered on the BATS exchange at $30 a share, while the full 10,000 listed on the other 12 exchanges were offered at $30.01, his broker was required to purchase the 100 shares on BATS at $30 before moving on to the other exchanges. It mandated routing to more exchanges than you might otherwise have to go to, said Schwal. And so it created more opportunities for people to front-run you. The regulation also made it far easier for high-frequency traders to predict where brokers would send their customers' orders, as they must send them first to the exchange that offered the best market price. That would have been fine, but for the manner in which the best market price was calculated. The new law required a mechanism for taking the measure of the entire market, for creating the national best bid and offer, by compiling all the bids and offers for all U.S. stocks in one place. That place, inside some computer, was called the Securities Information Processor, which, because there is no such thing on Wall Street as too many acronyms, became known as the SIP. The 13 stock markets piped their prices into the SIP, and the SIP calculated the NBBO. The SIP was the picture of the U.S. stock market most investors saw. Like a lot of regulations, Reg NMS was well-meaning and sensible. If everyone on Wall Street abided by the rule's spirit, the rule would have established a new fairness in the U.S. stock market. The rule, however, contained a loophole. It failed to specify the speed of the SIP. To gather and organize the stock prices from all the exchanges took milliseconds. It took milliseconds more to disseminate those calculations. The technology used to perform these calculations was old and slow, and the exchanges apparently had little interest in improving it. There was no rule against high-frequency traders setting up computers inside the exchanges and building their own, much faster, better cared-for version of the SIP. That's exactly what they had done. So well that there were times when the gap between the high-frequency traders' view of the market and that of ordinary investors could be 25 milliseconds, or twice the time it now took to travel from New York to Chicago and back again. Reg NMS was intended to create equality of opportunity in the U.S. stock market. Instead, it institutionalized a more pernicious inequality. A small class of insiders with the resources to create speed were now allowed to preview the market and trade on what they had seen. Thus, for example, the SIP might suggest to the ordinary investor in Apple Inc., that the stock was trading at 400 to 400.01. The investor would then give his broker his order to buy 1,000 shares at the market price, or $400.01. The infinitesimal period of time between the moment the order was submitted and the moment it was executed was gold to the traders with faster connections. How much gold depended on two variables. A, the gap in time between the public SIP and the private ones, and B, how much Apple's stock price bounced around. The bigger the gap in time, the greater the chance that Apple's stock price would have moved, and the more likely that a fast trader could stick an investor with an old price. That's why volatility was so valuable to high-frequency traders. It created new prices for fast traders to see first and to exploit. It wouldn't matter if some people in the market had an early glimpse of Apple's price if the price of Apple's shares never moved. Apple's stock moved a lot, of course. In a paper published in February 2013, a team of researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, showed that the SIP price of Apple stock and the price seen by traders with faster channels of market information differed 55,000 times in a single day. That meant that there were 55,000 times a day a high-frequency trader could exploit the SIP-generated ignorance of the wider market. 55,000 times a day, he might buy Apple shares at an outdated price, then turn around and sell them at the new, higher price, exploiting the ignorance of the slower-footed investor on either end of his trades. And that was only the most obvious way a high-frequency trader might use his advanced view of the market to make money. Schwal already knew a lot about the boring, nitty-gritty details of Reg NMS, as he had been in charge of implementing the new rule for the whole of Bank of America. He'd seen to the bank's need to build so-called smart order routers that could figure out which exchange had the official best price of any given stock, the NBBO, and send the customer's orders to that exchange. By complying with Reg NMS, he now understood, the smart order routers simply marched investors into various traps laid for them by high-frequency traders. At that point, I just got very, very pissed off, he said, that they are ripping off the retirement savings of the entire country through systematic fraud, and people don't even realize it. That just drives me up the fucking wall. His anger expressed itself in a search for greater detail. When he saw that Reg NMS had been created to correct for the market manipulation of the old NYSE specialists, he wanted to know, how had that corruption come about? He began another search. He discovered that the New York Stock Exchange specialists had been exploiting a loophole in some earlier regulation, which of course just led Schwal to ask, what event had led the SEC to create that regulation? Many hours later, he'd clawed his way back to the 1987 stock market crash, which, as it turned out, gave rise to the first, albeit crude, form of high-frequency trading. During the 1987 crash, Wall Street brokers, to avoid having to buy stock, had stopped answering their phones, and small investors were unable to enter their orders into the market. In response, the government regulators had mandated the creation of an electronic small order execution system so that the little guy's order could be sent into the market with the press of a key on a computer keyboard, without a stockbroker first taking it from him on the phone. Because a computer was able to transmit trades much faster than humans, the system was soon gamed by smart traders, for purposes having nothing to do with the little guy. At which point Schwal naturally asked, from whence came the regulation that had made brokers feel comfortable not answering their phones in the midst of the 1987 stock market crash? As it turns out, when you Google front-running and Wall Street and scandal, and you are hell-bent on following the search to its conclusion, the journey cannot be finished in an evening. At 5 o'clock Monday morning, Schwal finally went back inside his house. He slept for 2 hours, then rose and called Brad to tell him he wasn't coming to work. Then he set off for a Staten Island branch of the New York Public Library. There was quite a bit of vengeance on my mind, he said. As a high school junior, Schwal had been New York City's wrestling champion in the 119-pound division. He's the nicest guy in the world most of the time, said Brad. But then sometimes he's not. A streak of anger ran through him. And exactly where it came from, Schwal could not say, but he knew perfectly well what triggered it. Injustice. If I can fix something and fuck these people who are fucking the rest of this country, I'm going to do it, he said. The trigger for his most recent burst of feeling was Thor, But if you had asked him on Wednesday morning while he was still digging around the Staten Island Library instead of going to work, Schwal wouldn't have thought to mention Thor. Instead, he would have said, "I am trying to understand the origins of every form of front-running in the history of the United States." Several days later, he'd worked his way back to the late 1800s. The entire history of Wall Street was a story of scandals, it now seemed to him, linked together, tail to trunk, like circus elephants. Every systemic market injustice arose from some loophole in a regulation created to correct some prior injustice. No matter what the regulators did, some other intermediary found a way to react so there would be another form of front-running, he said. When he was done in the Staten Island Library, he returned to work, as if there was nothing unusual at all about the product manager having turned himself into a private eye. He'd learned several important things, he told his colleagues. First, there was nothing new about the behavior they were at war with. The U.S. financial markets had always been either corrupt or about to be corrupted. Second, there was zero chance that the problem would be solved by financial regulators. Or rather, the regulators might solve the narrow problem of front-running in the stock market by high-frequency traders, but whatever they did to solve the problem would create yet another opportunity for financial intermediaries to make money at the expense of investors. Schwal's final point was more aspiration than insight. For the first time in Wall Street history, the technology existed that eliminated entirely the need for financial intermediaries. Buyers and sellers in the U.S. stock market were now able to connect with each other without any need of a third party. The way that the technology had evolved gave me the conviction that we had a unique opportunity to solve the problem, he said. There was no longer any need for any human intervention. If they were going to somehow eliminate the Wall Street middlemen who had flourished for centuries, they needed to enlarge the frame of the picture they were creating. I was so concerned that we were talking about what we were doing as a solution to high-frequency trading, he said. It was bigger than that. The goal had to be to eliminate any unnecessary intermediation. Brad found it odd that his product manager had set off to investigate the history of Wall Street scandal. It was a bit like an offensive lineman choosing to skip practice to infiltrate the opposing team's locker room. But Schwal's side career as a private eye, at least at first, struck him as a harmless digression, of a piece with Schwal's tendency in meetings to go off on tangents. Once he gets on one of these bents, it's better just to let him go, said Brad. That's just him working 18-hour days instead of 14-hour days. Besides, they now had far bigger problems. By the middle of 2011, Thor's limitations were visible. We had this meteoric rise in our business the first year, and then it flatlines, said Brad. In an open market, when customers were offered a new and better product, they ditched their old product for it. Wall Street banks weren't subject to the usual open market forces. Investors paid Wall Street banks for all sorts of reasons, for research, to keep them sweet, to get private access to corporate executives, or simply because they had always done so. The way that they paid them was to give them their trades to execute. That is, they believed they needed to allocate some very large percentage of their trades to the big Wall Street banks simply to maintain existing relations with them. RBC's clients were now routinely calling to say, "Hey, we love using Thor, but there is only so much business we can do with you because we have to pay Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley." The Royal Bank of Canada was running away with the title of Wall Street's most popular broker by peddling a tool whose only purpose was to protect investors from the rest of Wall Street. The investors refused to draw the obvious conclusion that they should have a lot less to do with the rest of Wall Street. RBC had become the number one rated stockbroker in America, and yet was still only the ninth best paid. They would never attract more than a tiny fraction of America's stock market trades, and that fraction would never be enough to change the system. A guy Ronan knew at the big high-frequency trading shop Citadel called him one day and put the matter in a nutshell. "I know what you're doing. It's genius. And there's nothing we can do about it. But you are only 2% of the market." On top of that, the big Wall Street banks, seeing RBC's success, were seeking to undermine it, or at least to pretend to replicate it. The tech people at other firms are calling me and saying, "I want to do Thor. How does Thor work?" recalled Alan Zhang. The business people at the banks were now calling Ronan and Rob and offering them multiples of what they earned at RBC to leave. The whole of Wall Street had been in something like a 2-year hiring freeze, and yet these big banks were suggesting to Ronan, who had spent the past 15 years unable to get his foot in the door of any bank, that they'd pay him as much as $1.5 million to join them. Headhunters called Brad and told him that if he was willing to leave RBC for a competitor, the opening bid was $3 million a year, guaranteed. Just to keep his team in place, Brad arranged for RBC to create a pool of money and set it aside. If the guys hung around for 3 years, they would be handed the money and would wind up being paid something closer to their market value. RBC agreed to do it, probably because Brad did not ask for a piece of the action himself, and continued to work for far less than he could have made elsewhere. The bank's marketing department proposed to Brad, as a way to get some media attention for Thor, that he apply for a Wall Street Journal Technology Innovation Award. Brad had never heard of the Wall Street Journal's Technology Innovation Awards, but he thought that he might use the Wall Street Journal to tell the world just how corrupt the U.S. stock market had become. His bosses at RBC, when they got wind of his plans, wanted him to attend a lot of meetings to discuss what he might say to the Wall Street Journal. They worried about their relationships with other Wall Street banks and with the public exchanges. "They didn't want to ruffle anyone's feathers," says Brad. "There was not a lot I couldn't say in a small, closed forum, but they didn't want me saying it openly." He soon realized that while RBC would allow him to apply for awards, it would not let him describe publicly what Thor had inadvertently exposed: the manner in which HFT firms front-ran ordinary investors, the conflict of interest that brokers had when they were being paid by the exchanges to route orders, the conflict of interest the exchanges had when they were being paid $1 billion a year by HFT firms for faster access to market data, the implications of an exchange paying brokers to take liquidity, that Wall Street had found a way to bill investors without showing them the bill. "I had about 8 things I wanted to say to the journal," said Brad. "By the time I got through all these meetings, there was nothing to say. I was only allowed to say one of them, that we had found a way to route orders so they arrived at the exchanges simultaneously." That was the problem with being RBC nice. It rendered you incapable of going to war with nasty. Before Brad said anything at all to the Wall Street Journal, RBC's upper management felt they needed to inform the U.S. regulators of what little he planned to say. They asked Brad to prepare a report on Thor for the SEC, and then flew themselves down from Canada to join him in a big meeting with the SEC's Division of Trading and Markets staff. It was more about not wanting them to be embarrassed about not knowing about Thor than it was us thinking they were going to do something about it, Brad said. He had no idea what a meeting at the SEC was supposed to be like, and prepared as if he were testifying before Congress. As he read straight from the document he had written, the people around the table listened, stone-faced. "I was scared shitless," he said. When he was finished, an SEC staffer said, "What you are doing is not fair to high-frequency traders. You're not letting them get out of the way." "Excuse me," said Brad. The SEC staffer argued that it was unfair that high-frequency traders couldn't post phony bids and offers on the exchanges to extract information from actual investors without running the risk of having to stand by them. It was unfair that Thor forced them to honor the markets they claimed to be making. Brad just looked at the guy. He was a young Indian quant. Then a second staffer, a much older guy, raised his hand and said, "If they don't want to be on the offer, they shouldn't be there at all." A lively argument ensued, with the younger SEC staffers taking the side of high-frequency trading and the older half taking Brad's point. "There was no clear consensus," said Brad, "but it gave me a sense that they weren't going to be doing anything anytime soon." "There's a culture in the SEC of not getting into a dialogue with any individual who comes in," says a staffer who listened to Brad Katsuyama's presentation. "They don't want to give any one person an unfair peek at the way the SEC thinks, but it's a very defensive culture. And there were people in the room who had written some of the rules he was implicitly criticizing." After the meeting, RBC conducted a study, never released publicly, in which they found that more than 200 SEC staffers since 2007 had left their government jobs to work for high-frequency trading firms or the firms that lobbied Washington on their behalf. Some of these people had played central roles in deciding how, or even whether, to regulate high-frequency trading. For instance, in June 2010, the associate director of the SEC's Division of Trading and Markets, Elizabeth King, had quit the SEC to work for Getco. The SEC, like the public stock exchanges, had a kind of equity stake in the future revenues of high-frequency traders. The argument in favor of high-frequency traders had beaten the argument against them to the U.S. regulators. It ran as follows. Natural investors in stocks, the people who supply capital to companies, can't find each other. The buyers and sellers of any given stock don't show up in the market at the same time, so they needed an intermediary to bridge the gap, to buy from the seller and to sell to the buyer. The fully computerized market moved too fast for a human to intercede in it, and so the high-frequency traders had stepped in to do the job. Their importance could be inferred from their activity. In 2005, a quarter of all trades in the public stock markets were made by HFT firms. By 2008, that number had risen to 65%. Their new market dominance, so the argument went, was a sign of progress, not just necessary, but good for investors. Back when human beings sat in the middle of the stock market, the spreads between the bids and the offers of any given stock were a 16th of a percentage point. Now that computers did the job, the spread, at least in the more actively traded stocks, was typically a penny, or 0.01%. That, said the supporters of high-frequency trading, was evidence that more HFT meant more liquidity. The arguments against the high-frequency traders hadn't spread nearly so quickly. At any rate, Brad didn't hear them from the SEC. A distinction cried out to be made between trading activity and liquidity. A new trader could leap into a market and trade frantically inside it without adding anything of value to it. Imagine, for instance, that someone passed a rule in the U.S. stock market as it is currently configured that required every stock market trade to be front-run by a firm called Scalpers, Inc. Under this rule, each time you went to buy 1,000 shares